Moin und willkommen zu einer neuen Folge des New Minds AI Podcast. Heute wird's ein bisschen nerdiger. Ich spreche nämlich mit Julian. Und Julian war Chief Evangelist bei Hugging Face, also einer der zentralen Plattformen, wenn es um das Thema Open Source KI geht. Und hat da viele Fortune 1000 Unternehmen beraten und dabei unterstützt, KI-Technologie wirklich einzusetzen. Heute kümmert er sich mit seinem Unternehmen Arki immer mehr um das Thema Small Language Model und darum geht es auch in dieser Folge. Wir wollen nämlich ein bisschen nerdiger werden, ein bisschen in die Tiefe gehen. Wir sprechen nämlich über verschiedene Modelle, Small Language, Large Language, was ist ein Unterschied, Parameter, Modelle, Training, Open Source oder Open Weights, was ist eigentlich der Unterschied, und erklären das Ganze immer anhand von konkreten Beispielen. Denn KI wird uns alle betreffen und wie sie wirklich funktioniert, das wissen eigentlich die wenigsten. Und auch ich habe in dieser Folge einiges dazugelernt. Also diese Folge ist nicht nur spannend für Tech-Interessierte, sondern auch für alle, die mal verstehen wollen, was eigentlich unter der Haube von modernen KI-Systemen wirklich passiert. Und weil Julian aus Frankreich kommt, ist die Folge auf Englisch, aber das kriegt man gut hin. Im KI-Bereich sind ja sowieso die meisten Wörter auf Englisch. Also, ich wünsche dir ganz viel Spaß bei der Folge und jetzt ab rein.
New Minds AI. Eure wöchentliche Dosis KI mit Jens und Max. Seid dabei, wenn wir die Zukunft erkunden.
So, Julian, it's so nice to have you on the show. I'm really looking forward to get a little bit more nerdy in this episode and really talk about the foundation and the models and everything around that. But first of all, I would love to that you introduce yourself to our audience. So who are you and why AI?
Oh, that's a lot of questions. Thank you for having me on the podcast and thank you everybody for listening. I hope this will be insightful and hopefully funny. So, after all these years, I still define myself as a software engineer. That's how I started a century ago. And how I got into AI is, I think, a very natural evolution. About 15 years ago, I was a CTO and a VP engineering in different startups in Paris, you know, doing e-commerce and digital music, etc., different things. And of course, data was always on the radar, you know. So back then, we were working with all kinds of databases from MySQL to Postgres to Oracle. So, most of it was obviously, product information, customer information, catalogs, et cetera, et cetera. So data was already a big part of what I was doing and, you know, of what everyone was doing if you were dealing with web platforms back then. And then I joined in 2010, I joined an ad tech startup. And of course, ad tech, even back then, and the company was kind of a pioneering company in that respect, ad tech was really all about machine learning. You know, trying to predict clicks, trying to show the right ad to the right person at the right time, as we used to say. And obviously back then it wasn't at all about deep learning. It was statistical machine learning, more traditional algorithms. And I wasn't involved with the machine learning part, but I was involved on the infrastructure and the, what we would call today the MLOps. DevOps, MLOps part, plus some product development where we were actually using the algorithms. And so that kind of triggered my interest. I never wanted to see things as a black box, not as an engineer. I mean, I need to understand things in detail. That's how my brain works. And I felt I couldn't deploy and scale those algos at crazy, crazy scale. And when I mean crazy scale, I mean we had global data centers in Japan, in the US, in Europe, etc. So we had hundreds of thousands of requests per second. That's the scale we had. So I felt I couldn't get it done right with my team unless I understood a little bit what was going on and when things broke. Why were they breaking, etc. And they did break a number of times because, the data science or machine learning sandbox is one thing, and production at hundreds of thousands of hits per second is a different thing. Mm-hmm. So that created a whole kind of whole bunch of different issues that we had to fix. But anyway, so I started getting into it, figuring out, okay, what are we trying to do here? You know, what is this algo? What is the data we're working on? And so, you know, started to educate myself on all those topics. And then you know, when I joined AWS in 2015, after about 10 years of being a technical leader, you know, I got into the whole cloud thing, and then it was good timing, and it was I guess dumb luck, because I think by the end of 2016, AWS started launching their first machine learning and AI services. And in my team, I was in the technical evangelism team. You know, nobody really understood any of that. And of course, we had great service teams building the products and the services, but we had literally zero developer resources, zero even internal educational resources. And I saw, you know, that, well, I knew machine learning was powerful from my previous years, and I saw that AI and deep learning was going to be the next wave. And I felt, you know, somebody has to build the resources, somebody has to educate even our own teams and customers and developers on what this is, you know, if we're going to be successful. So I convinced my management to let me focus on AI and machine learning exclusively. That was a difficult discussion, but I'm stubborn.
Why was it difficult to get people to back then?
Because it was so nascent. It was so nascent, and they were like, "Oh yeah, but if you do that, you know, you're not going to do containers. You're not going to do serverless. You're not going to do, you know, whatever I was doing back then. You know, I tried to cover the full scope." The full spectrum of AWS services, and I tell them, no. I want to do it. Machine learning AI, right? It's important. Somebody has to do this. I want to do this, and you know, so let me do it. And you know, I guess I was annoying enough that they agreed and say, okay, well, just go do it. But you know, if you show no impact for yourself, we'll have another discussion. And like, yeah, okay, whatever. But anyway, so I started diving into that, and I rode the wave until, you know, I left AWS in 2021. I wrote a book on AWS services for ML, traveled all over the place, et cetera, et cetera. And then I joined Hugging Face in 2021. And funny enough, Hugging Face partnered with AWS in early 21. I was still at AWS back then. And I remember writing the launch blog post for the partnership. Yeah. And I thought, and I knew a little bit about Hugging Face, you know, their name was popping up all the time. And obviously the interest in the new so-called transformer models introduced by BERT, the Google BERT model a few years before, you know, that was on my radar, but I wasn't too much aware of Hugging Face. And, you know, double clicking on them with the partnership and the product integration that they had, you know, made me think, yeah, okay, maybe that's more in line with what I want to do after 6 great years at AWS, 6 very successful years. You know, I feel I've ticked almost all the boxes I wanted to tick at AWS. And I see that this startup is pioneering a new way of doing AI, a more powerful way of doing natural language processing at the time with those transformer models. And they stand for open source, which I like. So why not join them? So I joined them and stayed there for 3 years as chief evangelist, trying to wave the flag of open source AI and open source models, etc.
So one quick question there. So sometimes you hear that a person is an evangelist, a technical evangelist or something. What did you actually do there as in such a role? Ah. Waving the flag for open source, running through events, saying cool.
So different companies have different definitions. It's still a very you know, diverse role. So my flavor of it, the way I've been practicing it for the last 10 years almost, is that I need to be able to, you know, in the same day, sometime in the same afternoon, I need to be able to sit down with, you know, developers, data scientists, machine learning engineers, you know, the most hardcore technical people you can think of, and you know, double click into technical topics or technical issues until we figure it out. And then I need to be able to speak to potentially their C-level folks, or and try to explain the value proposition of again, open source AI at Hugging Face when I was there, or RCAI, the new company I joined a year ago. So it's zooming in and zooming out. So mm-hmm. you need to be as technically sharp as possible, and you know, I keep joking that after all these years, I think I'm sharper than ever. You know, I'm coding every day. I'm reading articles every day. I've hardly ever done as much tech or research stuff as now. Cool. At an age where, you know, CTOs tend to be happy with, you know, PowerPoints and Excel sheets and HR meetings and budgeting meetings. And yes, they will still complain that, oh, they don't do enough tech, but secretly, you know, they know they're incapable of that. So mm-hmm. that's my hot take. You know, I'm going to make new friends here. Thank you for the opportunity. But, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword, I guess.
Of course.
Is one of my mottos. So yeah, it means being sharp technically, still doing deep dive content. You know, I have a lot of that on my YouTube video.
Yes, really deep dive.
Extra stuff you don't see because it's customer work or partner work. But anyway, I'm having fun here. And then you need to be business savvy too, right? Because if you're talking to a CFO, a COO, or, you know, a VP of whatever, you know, line of business, they're not interested in how, you know, what kind of reinforcement learning technique you use for model X, Y, or Z. They don't really care. Mm-hmm. They don't really even care that you're using model X, Y, or Z. They want to know if AI is going to solve the particular business problem they're after, which at the end of the day can only be two things, generating revenue or cutting costs.
Yep.
Right? It's funny, point. Like people yep. are always asking me, what are the use cases for AI or Gen AI? It's very simple. Either you generate revenue or you save money. That's it. If you're not doing one of those two things,
yeah, just playing,
you know,
around.
It's innovation, which means, you know.
But innovation has to lead to some of those two cases anyway.
It's PR or pleasing the board or, you know, press release, fluffy material. So, yeah, so that's the job. That's the job of an evangelist. It's, for me, it's, you need to be able to, you know, get in the ring with the best technical teams and not make a fool of yourself. And you need to be able to go, you know, head to head, eye to eye, with Fortune 500 C level folks, sometimes even bigger than that, and just you know, show them that you can help them deliver whatever business value they're after. And yeah, again, do the same thing, potentially jump from one meeting to the next.
Cool.
So
very, very important role, actually. I never thought about that. What exactly the role?
I'm hoping it is.
it sounds like. I mean, it sounds like the ultimate ultimate position in a.
And company. Of course, you travel a lot. I forgot to mention that. Of course, okay. If you want to do it right, you know, you can't do all of it from your laptop in your in your right. office or home office. You have to fly. You have to fly and, you know, meet people where they are. And again, you know, there's nothing like direct discussion, you know, direct contact, you know, shaking hands, whiteboarding,
having a beer.
Yeah, whatever. You know, and people whatever appreciate that. It's you know, you flew to meet them, you flew to get on stage for them, et cetera, et cetera. And then they you create relationships that will last many, many years.
So, but now you're not anymore, not working at Hugging Face anymore, right? You have a new position. Maybe tell us a little bit what you're doing there.
I left Hugging Face about a year ago now, and I joined another US startup called RCAI. And there is a strong connection to Hugging Face because two of our co-founders were fairly early Hugging Face employees. And I worked with them when I was there. And they left, quicker than I did. But we stayed in touch and you know, then I was keeping an eye on them, of course, because they were smart people. And you know, when I thought I'd done whatever I could at Hugging Face to help them out and was looking for something else, I thought, okay, RC is focusing on two things, really. They're, from a technical perspective, they're focusing on small language models, and I'm sure we'll talk about those, as a really great alternative to large language models. And they want to do that for enterprise customers. So even though open source is still a major element in our, I would say, personal philosophy and company philosophy, we think that we can help real enterprise users get value from our products versus just, you know, serving the open source community, which Hugging Face does very, very well, with less focus on, I would say, products or enterprise delivery. So I felt more in line with that part, still innovating, still working with open source, but focusing really, really on building models versus, you know, sharing models and doing it for the enterprise crowd versus doing it for just the open source community.
For everyone. I mean,
more power to Hugging Face. You know, we're...
Yeah, it's crazy. I never started to code or learn to develop, but I, thanks to the whole AI speed and development, I'm now building stuff regular on Hugging Face, and it's incredible.
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit about models in general. So if you talk to maybe a friend who has no idea about tech, heard about ChatGPT, how would you explain someone like this who maybe have a laptop and a broad understanding of technology, what is a large language model or language model at all, and why is it so special?
Sure. So first of all, a model is an abstraction, okay? In machine learning, generally, the very reason why we build models is because we have a lot of existing data, you know. So we used to call it historical data, you know, customer transactions, you know, customers clicking on ads, that kind of stuff. So you have data that describes a certain domain, a certain slice of reality, okay? Mm-hmm. And what you want to do is be able to use that data to predict what's coming next. Okay, so analytics and business intelligence, etc., they use that historical data to explain what happened in the past. Okay, last week we sold that many T-shirts in Paris, and we sold that many shoes in London. Okay, great, and that's useful, right? Have a clear vision of the past. Mm-hmm. But machine learning and AI are about trying to predict the future. So obviously, because you don't know what the future looks like, you know, you have no data points. So you can only rely on what happened before and try to build an abstraction, which is really a mathematical representation of the previous data, hoping that it will generalize to the future data. Okay. Mm-hmm. So in the case of language models, the historical data that we have is a huge quantity of, let's say, English language or German language or French language or Chinese language, whatever language we're interested in, represented by web pages, Wikipedia, PDF files, YouTube captions, Reddit forums, the internet, right? Plus, so the public internet data plus all the data that companies are accumulating, okay? Contracts, invoices, product catalogs, product documentation, policies, compliance documents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, okay? So that's the data that you have. So the goal of a language model is to be able to understand not just the vocabulary, but also the relationship between the words, okay? Mm-hmm. And you can only do that by training those models on a huge corpus of data. And when I mean huge, I mean huge. And that's why those large language models
cost, how huge?
The whole internet.
Oh, yeah, that's probably quite huge.
The whole internet, if you can. And that's pretty much what those large language models are trying to do. And it's safe to assume that if you put data on a public internet page, before you know it, it's going to be factored into a training set for one of those humongous LLMs. And so you try to understand the relationship between the words, and you try to predict, complete, you know, a sentence. And that's really what those Gen AI models are trained on. They're trained to generate the next word. Okay, and let me give you an example. If I say, I'm in Los Angeles, the sky is
blue.
Probably blue, right?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, probably. All right, it could be gray because of the pollution, but
true.
or the forest fires. But generally, it's going to be blue, right? If I say I'm in London and the sky is
definitely gray,
probably gray, you know. Yeah. No offense to my London friends, but it happens a lot. I could say the same about Paris. So there you go, right? These are a little bit silly examples, but you get the point. Why you say blue is because, well, Los Angeles, you know, is California. And California usually has nice weather. So you associate the sky entity with the Los Angeles entity and the California hidden entity. And you come to the obvious conclusion that the most likely word is blue. Okay. And same for London, where, you know, London is a nice place, but it's not known for its amazing weather, and it's probably gray. Okay. And that's exactly, so what you just did there is you analyze the context of that sentence and you predicted the next word. And the most likely word, the one with the highest probability in your mind, of course you never thought about it that way, but it's that way, is gray or blue. And that's how you train models. So in AI speak, you call this next token generation. Because there's a bit of a difference between words and tokens. Models are trained on tokens. For example, if you say unhappiness is one word, but it would probably be three tokens to a model.
Okay, so part of a word,
right?
Basically.
Happy is the core, and unhappy means not happy, and nest is the state of not being happy. And those are three different things, right? There's the concept of being happy, or the negation of it, and then the state, right? The emotion that you feel. And so those nuances would need to be picked by the model. So next token generation, you know, you can simplify it as predicting the next word, which means, okay, I've been trained on, you know, a zillion web pages, and that corpus has maybe, I don't know, 150,000 unique words. Okay. The vocabulary is that. So every time I need to generate the next token, I have to find out of those 150,000 words or tokens, which one is the likeliest. And the way a model knows that, it's because it's been trained for a long, long time at huge expense of, GPU capacity, et cetera, to figure out that given the start of this sentence, the next word is going to be this. And then once you've completed the sentence with a token, then you do it again and again and again and again.
And at an incredible speed and quality. When you started with AI, or maybe when you joined Hugging Face, back then, did you expect that it's getting as good as it now with the latest models?
No, I think, you know, in hindsight, a lot of people, you know, people love to rewrite history. But, you know, I was in the middle of that. And the research papers were out there, you know, in 2021, 2022. So the foundational research papers that OpenAI used to build ChatGPT were out there. Reinforcement learning with human feedback, et cetera, et cetera. I think no one really thought some organization would put them to work that quickly, that well, and at that scale.
Mm-hmm.
And then make it available to the world. So I think
in the chat box.
Yeah, the genius. That's crazy. I think the genius of OpenAI was, you know, making the research papers work at scale, and then instead of building, a generative model, and you know, selling it or I don't know, you know, selling it to, you know, Microsoft or whoever for a web search or something, just building the simplest of web interfaces and exposing it to the world. I think that was the genius. Yep. And you know, folks will tell you, oh yeah, we saw it coming, because we had some, like OpenAI, true to their name, had released open source models, right?
Mm-hmm.
So GPT, we didn't call it GPT-1, but GPT was there, GPT-2 was there. They were open models. They were not amazing, okay? But they were there. So there was already a sense of, oh, now we're trying to build generative AI models.
Mm-hmm.
But the gap between GPT-2 and you know, GPT-3.5 and ChatGPT, et cetera, was so huge that, you know, you couldn't see that coming. You know, I will readily admit I didn't see it coming, and a lot of companies, you know, including big tech companies, were completely blindsided.
Yeah, I mean, many German companies are also still blindsided by this. when you're talking about training a model, maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because when we hear about the news and OpenAI training a model. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe give us a few insights how to train a model? What's the challenge there? How long does it take?
Sure.
I mean, training back then was probably taking longer than now. But what is all about training, and do we need training in the future?
So training starts with data. Okay. And you know, I keep telling customers who are very excited about, you know, models and how many billion parameters they want to use, et cetera. I you know, respectfully, I try to bring them back to the first step, which is, okay, so what's the problem you want to solve? Are you sure this is an AI and a Gen AI problem? And those sound like stupid questions, but you'd be surprised.
Oh, yes.
And okay, assuming the answer to those is yes, I try to figure out if we can use an off-the-shelf model, right? And again, Hugging Face has something like 1.8 million. Yes, you heard that right. 1.8 million models available.
Wow. Different models.
Oh, yeah, all kinds. All sizes, all flavors, all colors.
Crazy.
So there's a chance one of them could be a good starting point. And potentially even be the only thing you need, right? But okay, assuming that you need deep domain knowledge, et cetera, and you may need to do some training, okay? Some additional training. So I think we really need to break the market, so to speak, into two categories. I think you have model builders. Okay, so folks like, OpenAI and Meta and Google and Mistral, Alibaba with the famous Quen models. And in all humility, I think RC is part of the club now. We released our first foundation model last week.
Nice.
So folks like those companies who are intent on creating models from scratch, okay? Meaning defining, inventing a new model architecture, okay? And that's a very technical discussion, so I don't want to bore you with the details, but basically coming up with novel ways to organize those neural networks, right? For increased accuracy, increased speed, etc. And then training those models from scratch on a huge, huge amount of data, which needs to be high quality, which will always rely on, like I said, public internet data, but curated, cleaned, and where you work hard to eliminate, the toxic stuff.
So let's assume I work in a company. We have a lot of data in house. We have product catalogs or something. At what level does it make sense to train a model from the ground up?
Makes no sense whatsoever.
Okay, so, good point.
So that group of companies do what we call pre-training, okay, which is really, hey, here's a blank model architecture, okay? It's just a blueprint. So it's not initialized, it's just a blueprint. Now let's train it on, zillions of tokens and come up with something interesting. So this is just, every time I meet companies who tell me they want to do this, I have to say it's fewer now than it used to be. I think people are getting reasonable. I always try to challenge that to the max because I know they probably don't have enough data. They probably don't have the skills. They're going to end up burning lots of money and be very, very disappointed. And that's just the wrong way to do it. So unless you want to get into model building as a business, you shouldn't do that. And so the other group of companies is what you're describing, which is, hey, I'm a bank, I'm an insurance company, I'm a car manufacturer, I'm an e-commerce website. I have some domain-specific and company-specific data that I think is high value, right? For customer support applications or document analysis or knowledge bases or all those popular scenarios. How do I apply that good data to a model to get incremental value on top of what I would get with just downloading a model from Hugging Face? So I would argue that you still need to start with the off-the-shelf models because if anything, you're going to get a baseline on accuracy and domain knowledge and speed, et cetera, et cetera. And again, for some use cases, which could be vanilla enough, that's probably all you need. Okay, job done. If you do need to train, then of course you're not going to do pre-training because that's what Mistral or Meta or Google did. What you're going to do is called fine-tuning.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to take your good company data. You still need to curate it and prepare it. And you will run additional training to inject that domain knowledge into that base model that you experimented with. Okay. And the purpose here is to make the model just more knowledgeable about your domain and maybe also help it answer your questions in a way that is in line with your expectations, which could be safety, compliance, tone of voice, et cetera, right? If you're building, a medical chatbot, and it even if it gives you all the facts, if it does it speaking like a 13-year-old, excited teenager, that's not going to work, right?
Okay, got it.
Hey, Julie, I'm super happy to inform you that you have cancer, but don't worry. That's okay. You're going to be fine. Yeah, of course. Sorry for that horrible example, but you know what I mean.
You get the point. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just making the point. So, that fine tuning step is again all about specializing the model for domain knowledge for, like I said, tone of voice, safety, etc. And you can do that yourself, right? That's the beauty of an open weights model. Just download them from Hugging Face and get to work on them. Or you can work with companies. And, you know, we do that for customers. We help them work with their data, and we help them fine tune and tailor the models for a particular use case. And more often than not, the model they'll get out of that will not only be better than the base model we started from, which is the very minimum, that customized model will also be better at the task than the larger models. We just did a project a few weeks ago with a company in the US called Madeline & Co. So they're a design and business strategy studio, right? And we took a 32 billion parameter model. So trust me, that sounds huge, but it's not too big, and it's a fraction of the size of OpenAI, Anthropic, etc. We adapted it and with their data, and then they run their benchmarks, their human benchmarks, and they did human preference testing, you know, A versus B, which one do you prefer, with their model versus GPT-4 and the Claude models from Anthropic. And the results were outstanding. On most benchmarks, they preferred their model over 80-85% of the time. But of course, it's a small model. It's all theirs. It's cheaper to run, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what we're advocating for. You know, that's what we're championing. Understanding that in a lot of enterprise scenarios, you don't need the wealth of knowledge that a large language model like you know, GPT-4 will bring. You don't want cooking recipes. You don't want poetry. You don't want astronomy questions. You don't want homework assistance. All those things are useful, but in your context, you want to help your big brand customers come up with media strategies, you know, scripting, storyboards, scripting ad campaigns, that kind of stuff. And that's one thing. And it's a very thin slice of human knowledge, right? So you don't need the model to be a mile wide and an inch deep, or I should say a kilometer wide and a centimeter deep. There you go, right? Whether you like the metric system or not, you know what I'm saying? You need it the other way, right? So you need a centimeter wide and a kilometer deep. And that's absolutely possible with a smaller model and the right training and fine-tuning techniques. And if you do all of that right, you will outperform the larger models at a fraction of the cost.
But would you say that, I mean, the bigger models, the large language models are going all for scale, so scaling as much as possible, building Stargate training models as a, I don't know, size, which is incredible. But when you compare it to small language models, and you just named as an example, building a campaign, for example, which also, of course, includes some kind of creativity. Of course, you can just train with your old data and make a small language model. But would a big model be maybe more creative?
That's a great question.
Thinking outside of the box,
That's a great question. Joke. And I would have absolutely agreed. Until we started seeing, reasoning models. I would say reasoning capable small language models. And in fact, the project I was just mentioning with Madeline, we actually used one of those reasoning models. So
just sum it up really quick. What is a reasoning model?
So at the core, it will still generate the next word, right? People read too much into those models. So they still, they're chatty and, you know, verbose, and they just never shut up, okay? The difference is that a reasoning model was trained to not just give you the answer, but also give you a text description of how it came up with the answer. So the answer that you'll get comes always in two parts. You have the thinking part, and you can literally see the model, you know, in, and I'm putting big quotes here, because I don't want people to read too much into it, speaking to itself. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it would be like you or me, you know, trying to figure out a solution. It's like, okay, so, all right. So, Jens asked me to prepare for a podcast on AI. Okay. So what should we talk about? Well, I think we should define what AI is. And then maybe we should talk about LLMs. Oh, but wait, if we talk about LLMs, then we need to explain what models are and what language. And okay, so it rambles for a while. Mm-hmm. And then when it's satisfied, you know, that it's got the right thing to say, then it will generate the answer. And you could say, well, what's the point? I mean, just give me the damn answer, right?
Yeah, true.
But looking at how the model came up with the answer can generally brings me two things. It brings me insights into, okay, this looks reasonable, you know, pun not intended. This is probably a decent way to look and, you know, analyze the problem and break it down into smaller problems, et cetera, et cetera. So it helps you build trust. Okay, it's not just a canned answer that I got that the model memorized from its training set, or it's not an hallucination. It's something that sounds reasonable. And the second thing I get out of it is a lot of times, actually, it will help me think about certain aspects of the problem that I did not consider. You know, so I read the reasoning thing and I was like, oh, it took that into account. Oh yeah, didn't think about it. And then usually I'll edit my prompt and say, okay, yes, when it comes to blah blah blah, I'd like blah blah blah. Okay, and it helps steer, you know, like narrow down maybe the possibilities and get to a better answer. So yeah, reasoning models are really great.
So you're also saying that the answer is better.
Yeah, most of the time, you know, it depends. It depends what kind of question you ask. You know, if like not all prompts are good reasoning prompts. Sometimes they're just knowledge based, you know, prompt. Yeah, and using a reasoning model for that is just a waste of compute time. But any time you do need you know, to break down a problem into smaller problems, I think reasoning is very interesting. And for coding particularly, like coding tasks work very well. Yes. You know, deep research tasks work very well. And again, I think if you use it just as a way to discover the problem, right? It would just mean, as you know, let's say you're the expert in market research and I'm asking you a fairly fuzzy question on, you know, I'm trying to do research on, you know, pet food in Australia and whatever, you know, something weird. Mm-hmm. I have no clue. I don't even know what question to ask. Mm-hmm. And listening to you talking to yourself about the problem will teach me a lot as well. And
That's actually a very good tip to keep on reading the thinking process as well, because you usually, I mean, OpenAI is, ChatGPT is designed to hide the thinking steps if you don't click on it. Yep. But
no, I would recommend reading it. That's
cool.
Most of the time, it's more interesting than the answer. And it will help you get to a better prompt. Mm-hmm. Then you get the really great answer, because you're discovering the problem, you're asking the question in a much better way, and the model does a better job, right? And so now we have really, really great open weights reasoning models. So if the question is there something today that you literally cannot do at all with open weights models? I would have to think a little bit about it. I would say in my daily usage, I would think code, advanced coding, code refactoring, etc. still works better with the larger models. Mm-hmm. I mean, if any of you out there is using tools like, you know, Cursor, etc.
Oh yes,
you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not perfect, but sometimes they get over enthusiastic and generate, you know, 9 pages of code where, you know, you really only wanted 5 lines. But okay, still doing a very good job, I would say, for a lot. And especially a lot of enterprise tasks. Okay, that's my angle. You know, Like, I'm not trying to find a cure for cancer or, you know, solve world peace. And if there is such a solution, especially not these days, but if you focus on enterprise problems, think about, you know, all of you listening to us right now, think about, you know, five problems that you have to solve every day. They're probably solvable with open weights models, and you don't need the bigger, super complex, super expensive, and sometimes super slow LLMs to get them done.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you're in on an enterprise level, I mean, you need resources to run this kind of models. Everyone who run or try to run a local model on their computer with a decent machine without and having maybe a too big of model is probably aiming at one token per second. This is not fun at all.
It's a good point, actually. I think, it leads me to another angle here, which is models are getting smaller and smaller, yet they're better and better. Okay, so because some companies have so heavily relied on parametric count to tell you, oh, you know, we have a bigger model, it's better. We have an even bigger one, and now it's better. I think there's a wrong sense of, a 70 billion parameter model is always better than an 8 billion parameter model. Mm. So this is true at a point in time, but it rots. That statement rots extremely quickly. Okay. And I'll give you an example. So earlier this year, I think it was February, we released a 10 billion parameter model that outperformed our own 72 billion parameter model from 6 months before.
Oh, wow.
And before you tell me, yeah, maybe that 72 model was awful, it was not. It was the best 72 billion parameter model available on Hugging Face. So from July to February, so let's say 6-7 months time, we were able to give the community a model 7x smaller and, you know, at least maybe 10 or 15% 10 or 15% better on most benchmarks.
Okay. Do you see an exponential development here?
So I think the main reason is data quality. Mm-hmm. A lot of teams report that, like, significant improvements in model accuracy, model quality through better data curation, data preparation technique. And also, obviously, the training recipes get smarter and smarter and smarter.
What do you mean with training recipes?
So the training techniques used train or fine tune the models, the ability to apply, you know, reinforcement learning techniques without the need for human feedback. So basically, reinforcement learning with AI, etc., and lowering the compute cost of those reinforcement learning techniques. You don't have to have billions of VC money to run them anymore. So better data, better, more cost efficient training, you know, model building techniques, and just better teams. And that gives you have this compounding effect where a much smaller model outperforms everything that came before.
And if small models getting smarter, obviously cheaper, performance raising, why are the big models keep building data centers for $500 billion?
That's an interesting point. You would need to ask them. You would need to ask them. I'm not quite sure what they're after. Okay.
AGI.
I don't know what that is. I don't know what that is. And I've met, you know, in the last 2-3 years, I've met probably 200 or 300 customers. Not one asked me for that. Okay. So feels to me, again, you know, it's, they're on a quest to something. So, you know, it could be, you know, web scale domination for, you know, search and et cetera, et cetera. Or it could be something else. I don't really know. I mean, I don't really care. You know, if I wanted to be cynical, I think those, I mean, those, a lot of those guys have books and keynotes to sell. They're making predictions, and I'm not going to name them because I have a huge amount of respect for some of them. But, you know, some very, very famous figures said, you know, by 2015, you know, AI will replace radiologists, AI will replace developers, AI will replace whoever. I mean, okay, sorry.
I think by now we should also be we should lose hallucination after all. I think
yeah. So it's you know they're I don't know what they're after. I'm not super interested. Right now I know we can help. You know thousands and thousands of organizations getting business value really quickly. You know, in a matter of weeks, not in a matter of months or years, solving problems for their organizations, being more efficient, being more, agile, in turn, creating value for their customers. And whatever the value is, it could be, you know, if you're a private business, great. I mean, you know, you generate more revenue, more margin, you have a more sustainable business, you can grow. That's a good thing in my book. Or, you know, if you're in public sector, you can improve healthcare, you can improve education, you can improve, I don't know, transportation and whatnot. And all those things need, progress today. And we don't need AGI for that, whatever that is.
True. I mean, if you look at the models and the benchmarks, if you believe in some of the benchmarks, we already have, a few models who are, in some ways, may be based on the benchmark smarter than most humans. So why do we?
So
and we still have. I mean, you're talking to companies. I talk a lot to companies. We know that they're not at the peak of the technology possibilities. So
no, and let's be. I mean, let's be honest. A lot of business processes do not require, advanced intelligence. You know. It's a lot of them are automation, a lot of them are document processing, et cetera. So again, if you want to find a general cure to all forms of cancer, okay, I mean, more power to you. But I'm not sure this will come out of a multi-trillion parameter model, honestly. I think we'll be surprised.
What comes after out of Stargate and stuff like that.
And again, I think it's, you know, it's become, and you know, I stay away from politics, but it's become, geopolitical play for a lot of, governments.
I mean, if you look, at China, how quickly they develop new models and how, especially
but they have to, right? I mean, there are a lot of things I don't like at all about China, the Chinese state. But you know, I live in Europe, right? I'm in France, and I keep having this discussion with folks in America. I tell them, hey, I'm in the middle, you know, I can look east and I can look west and I can look south. And if I look east, or when I'm east, because I travel a lot, you know, when I'm east and I listen to people, you know, it's, can you really ask them to blindly trust West Coast companies with not just their company data, but maybe their healthcare data, their government data? Seriously? Mm-hmm. I mean, if I fly west, you know, and I ask American companies to blindly trust a Chinese built model, a Chinese built company with their data and government data and healthcare data, what are they saying? You know?
Yeah.
So I think the world, you know, AI used to be an R&D topic. Now it's again, it's a geopolitical topic. It's a sovereignty topic from a business perspective. You know, if you have the best AI models, you have a competitive advantage. If you have the best AI chips, you have a competitive advantage. And so it's a weapon, in the global economy, and sometimes beyond that, right? Unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, if you want to keep trusting the West Coast guys, or if you want to keep trusting the Chinese guys, it's up to you, right? Make up your move, make up your decision. But
in Europe, and we're trusting no one, basically.
Yeah, and we trust no one, but we build nothing. So,
bad combination. I mean, we have Mistral, but
Look at their investors. I mean, I love Mistral. More power to them. I'm super impressed. Yeah. But they and I see why, from a business perspective, they have to wave the French flag, and I'm all for waving the French flag, right? Not just football games, but. Seriously, you know, that doesn't reflect the full truth. So, mm-hmm. So Europe, the first thing that Europe did was regulation before even having sovereign models. So, yeah, we'll see. I think in my opinion, Europe will be the horrible loser in the race. But that's, you know, not for me to judge. That's just what I'm. That's my own prediction.
I think if we talk about Europe, it will be a really sad podcast for now.
Yeah, but yeah.
I have another topic I would love to discuss with you. Because you, during our conversation, you talked a lot about open source, but also open weights.
Oh, yes.
And I think when you see headlines like Meta's releasing Llama 4, open source, the idea in basically most of the people heads are, okay, this is Llama is basically Meta's releasing everything for free. You see everything in the model.
Yeah.
But is that true? Or what is the difference between open source? What is this open weights thing?
Yeah, that's why I've upgraded myself to saying open weights now. So if you catch me saying open source models, feel free to react.
I will have a buzzer.
Yeah, exactly. but yeah, I think they really are open weights, meaning that the architecture, so again, you know, the creative way to arrange those neural networks is open, okay? That's, again, a lot of credit goes to Hugging Face for building the tools to let you load the models, inspect the models, et cetera, et cetera. The weights are open, okay, you get access to all the weights, all those parameter values inside the model.
So can you get as deep as the data, the training data, no, or
so
what
a
is the
weight is basically, okay, to simplify things a little bit, it's a numerical value attached to a connection between two neurons.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so a weight is really just reflecting how important the connection between two neurons is.
Okay. Sounds like a brain.
Yes. unfortunately, because again, I think the human brain is probably much more complicated and sophisticated and impenetrable as neural networks are. But I think, and I'm happy about that actually. But yes, that's the abstraction, okay? Mm-hmm. Neurons are connected. How strong the connection is, how meaningful the connection is reflected by this numerical value. Okay. So, so the architecture is open. The weights are open. That's useful. You can load them, test them, inspect them. You know, you can do a lot. Now, there's still a ton of stuff you don't get. So, for example, you don't get the training data most of the time. Very, very few models share their full training sets, okay? Which creates all kinds of concerns about. So initially, people were really obsessed with, you know, bias and et cetera, and that's a fair concern. But I think, again, in the enterprise world, the bigger concern is there any copyrighted data in there, right? If I use the model and it spits out some, you know, paywall data, am I liable? You know, probably yes. And what happens next? And even figuring that out, if you don't have access to the data, is complicated.
Mm.
You don't have the training code. Okay, so the actual code, the actual recipes that were applied to the model, you don't get them. So it's like eating a cake without having the recipe or the ingredients. You know,
still delicious, but you have no idea what you're eating.
Trust me, it's great, and maybe it might be. You know, mm-hmm. but I mean, you know, if you're allergic to nuts,
good point.
Yeah, you want to know, right? And I think a lot of companies are allergic to New York Times articles in the training set. So there's still a lot of I would say artifacts that are missing for those models to be called open source, right? If you want it to be honest, you'd say, okay, open source means I have 100% of the artifacts that I need to fully reproduce the model if I wanted to.
Right. So real open source would be the training data, the way
the recipes,
okay.
And the final models, et cetera.
If you had the hardware, you could just rebuild exactly.
Yeah, if you had $100 million and enough GPU capacity, you could just launch the training script and reproduce it. To their credit, Hugging Face did publish a few models like that, and I think a few organizations did, but mostly for research purposes. When it comes to, you know, the big names, no, of course no one's doing it, because by now you should start to understand that the secret sauce is the data and the training recipe. So, you know, if you're an amazing cook or an amazing chef, you know, you have your trade secrets. You know, you don't want to you source your ingredients from very select producers, and you know, you've spent 30 years becoming great at what you're doing, and you're not going to give it away for free. You know, it's your business, it's your livelihood. So,
yeah, I think also when it comes to training data, I mean, if you look at the at the core trials that are currently out there, every big model is basically sued for some kind of data violation.
Absolutely. So, OpenAI is being sued, and Anthropic is being sued. Meta, and again, more power to them. They're doing an amazing work. Meta AI. The Llama models are completely tainted with paywall data. There's even a website. There's a website out there that lets you inspect, you know, if a certain data source is part of the training set. And, you know, I wrote a technical book and it's in there. I'm not aware of either myself or my publisher, giving rights. The Harry Potter books, I mean, you know, I'm negligible, but it's a much bigger concern.
As you said, I mean, high quality data is needed. So I guess from my point of view, the big models will do as much as possible to get as much data as possible. And this leads to better integration. Just upload your CSV file. We can handle that. Sure. Easier integrations in your daily life, into multimodality, images, videos. So data is the new gold for the big models? Do you think there's a data fight?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Licensing, you know, I think it's, licensing deals are important. And I'm sure, you know, they may be pushing for exclusivity deals because imagine, I don't know, just making up examples here, the Bundesliga or the Formula One governing body, you know, signing an exclusive deal for all their data with OpenAI or Anthropic or Meta, right? Like, no, none of our data can be part of those models. Like, you cannot use any of those digital properties and data sets unless you paid a fee, right? And digital music, you know, it took a while. You know, I was in that field for years. Digital music implemented it finally, right? I mean, you had Napster, and all of a sudden, music was dead, and record companies were dead, and et cetera, et cetera. And then, through law, you know, and the digital acts, et cetera, and through litigation and through, you know, they reversed that situation, and now they're getting paid, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars to share their catalogs with Spotify and Deezer and you know, all other platforms, you know, iTunes, et cetera, et cetera. So all it
and
takes...
Nowadays, there's Zuno and Udio.
Yep.
And killing it.
Yeah. And they're doing well. And it's fair to say, I probably shouldn't say that on record, but I've stopped downloading albums years and years ago, right? Doesn't mean I'm buying a lot of CDs again. I'm more of a vinyl guy, as you can probably guess. Ah, yeah, you're not getting the video.
No, but I can hear
it. There are a few posters in the back. But I'm a happy Spotify client, and that's fine. Yes, I'm happy to pay every month. So I think all it takes is a U.S. judge to decide that it wasn't okay for OpenAI or whoever to grab all the data from the New York Times and all those media companies that are suing, and put a nice $1 billion fine on top of that. And I think that's when people will become more reasonable about it. Right now, everybody's turning like their heads and ignoring the problem. But, the US court system has a lot of problems. But, from time to time, you have this super high profile ruling that changes an industry. You know, it happened for tobacco. It happened for, pesticides, it happened for a number of things. It might happen for AI, where they just say, okay, enough, guys. Now you need to pay content creators the right amount of data. How you do that is up to you, but
I think it's gonna be
a new industry of rights management for AI data sets.
I think the challenge with AI is that if there's a court that rules like this and they have to pay a fine and stuff like that, other countries, for example, like China, they just don't care.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, you said tobacco as example. Then, I mean, if it's a physical object, you can restrict imports and stuff like that. You have full control, basically, at least good control. But with AI, then I would just go to DeepSeek or whatever, or Tencent or Alibaba, and use their model. They train with everything.
And then you get your data stolen by them.
Of course.
Yeah, I think it's for regulated companies, it is a major problem. It goes both ways, right? Is our own data at risk? Will the data that we send to those companies be used for training, or potentially even more, even nastier purposes? And the other way is, is there a liability risk because we're going to use generated data that is tainted with intellectual property that they haven't paid for? And again, it's the wild, wild west right now.
Oh, yes, definitely.
And you always have bad actors who will ignore or have a very different take on intellectual property. And that's the way of the world. But if you're a listed company in the US, you can't take the risk. And I mean, we're talking about RC for a second. I mentioned we launched a foundation model last week. It's actually the first of a family called AFM RC Foundation Models. And a lot of the effort was in curating the data so that, although we'd love to say it's 100% free of copyrighted data and paywall data, it's difficult to say 100%. So I'll just say 99.99999 because I don't want to stand in court. We paid with our partner, we paid a lot of effort in curating and removing and using only trusted sources to be free of that problem. And that came not because we're philosophers or, IP is IP and we try to respect that, but just because customers ask for it. They said, we love small language models. We love Llama and we love Mistral and we love all those models and they're doing amazing work for sure. But you know, we're worried about intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
We're worried about what those models were trained on, and compliance is making it very, very hard for us to use those models, sometimes even internally, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you're listening to me and you work in a two people startup or you're a student, it's like, yeah, we don't care. It's like, yeah, go build stuff and then figure it out later. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can live with that. But if you work in a bank, if you work in healthcare, if you work in government, if you work in defense, etc., you know, there's a ton of fields and companies who have to apply compliance, right?
Yes,
a definitely. Lot.
More than you think,
my startup friends. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And if you're building for them, they will ask you the same questions. So maybe you don't need to worry about it for you, but you will have to worry about it because your customers will ask that.
And then you're reliable in the end.
And then you're liable in it. So working with clean models and clean data it cannot be just it's not nice to have.
Don't we already have a solution? So I'm overreacting here, but maybe we can just use synthetic data. So if we have a big model like OpenAI, maybe they train bigger, can't we? I mean, every knowledge is basically in the big models. Can we just generate tons and tons of synthetic data because the models have such a good world understanding that they actually can recreate everything that we ask them for? Isn't that a solution?
So synthetic data is useful, and we use some of it to train our own models, but it's a chicken and egg problem, okay? Because if the model is tainted, right? And that taint could show up in the synthetic data as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
For example, if I ask one of those large models, hey, write a short story in the style of, Stephen King or H.P. Lovecraft, and, you know, make it at least 10,000 words, et cetera, et cetera. And I've done this a number of times. The quality, what you get is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what you get is amazing. And if I didn't know better and I read a blog post or, you know, from a slightly reasonable media outlet, right, saying, you know, new 29 new Lovecraft short stories discovered in an attic in, you know, London. Maybe not London, because let's say New York or Providence, that's where he lived. And they give you some samples and you would read them and it's like, yeah, man, this is amazing. This is the real thing, you know? Why? Because the models have been trained on all that data. Mm-hmm. So synthetic, be careful what you're asking for. If you're giving the model some of your data, and you're using synthetic data to expand on it, you know, diversify it, give you more of it, but slightly different. I think that's a good way to do it. Plus, you're working with your own data. So, well, it's your IP anyway, so there's no real risk. But if you're trying to replicate net new data, similar to something else that is copyrighted. I mean, you could still argue it's plagiarism, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you write short stories for kids and they look suspiciously like, Harry Potter stories or Lord of the Rings stories, again, you could be called out, you know? And I mean, in the music industry, it happens a lot, you know, this song is suspiciously similar to that song.
Yes.
And again, it's up to the judge to decide. So,
if we ignore like stories for it or IP stuff, is it possible to have a good quality set of synthetic data for my own business data, basically, so market research? Let's assume my target group is, I don't know, driving a Porsche and is 40 plus years,
sure.
And I can't get them to do my surveys. So can I just recreate everything and get a good quality?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of that. Yeah, there's a lot of that. I think what I would recommend is getting whatever surveys you have and using that as a starting point to generate more, which would at least ground that synthetic data into some form of reality versus generating completely from scratch, where, you know, honestly, you're rolling the dice on what the model knows or doesn't know. And obviously you could review that data, but at scale, you know, it's not really feasible. So, you know, it's like mad cow disease, right? Feeding models or training models on data generated by models. You know, where does that end? You know?
Do you have an answer to that? I would love to.
I'm sure it's toxic at some point. Yeah.
Why?
Because you're whatever. It's a compounding effect. You know, whatever lack of knowledge, or whatever bias, and I don't mean bias as in, you know, gender. I mean, not necessarily. I mean all kinds of bias, right? Mm-hmm. You know, let's say this model doesn't know much about Botswana, and doesn't know anything about Botswana, so it's never going to talk about Botswana. And maybe you have Porsche buyers who come from Botswana and they have unique needs. Okay, again, that's a horrible example, but you get my point. So what it doesn't know, or what it's wrong about, or what it's likely to hallucinate about, will just be repeated and repeated and repeated, right? So it's a magnifying glass, you know. So
the bias,
if you generate 10,000 question and answer pairs that keep amplifying a defect, then the next model you train on that has a bigger defect. You know, so it's that negative feedback. Well, positive actually. It's that positive feedback loop that, you know, keeps growing and growing and growing until something goes really bad.
In my head, I sometimes tend to compare it to how humans. I mean, we also compound knowledge, we learn and adapt. But I think we have, since there are new humans every day on the world, we have like a small kind of reset feeling where people start to relearn something. And this, I think this doesn't happen in AI.
What's in the training set is in the training set, you know, and it will just grow and grow and grow. And it's more fun to add data in a day to a training set than to remove data. You know,
true.
So it's the long-term curation of that data is a very interesting question, you know, because it's new. It's basically human knowledge, you know, and you could argue that there comes a point in time where all human knowledge, right, with all its contradictions, with all its repetition, etc., is present in a data set. Okay,
that's crazy.
So what do you remove? Should you remove anything, you know?
Yeah, who should remove what? Yeah,
and true. And yeah, like healthcare typically is interesting, because the same surgical procedure has certainly evolved a lot over the last 30 years. Okay, so if you're gonna, it was a learning process, you know. Like appendicitis in the 30s and appendicitis in the 50s and then the 70s. And now, okay, it's the same problem. The human body hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. The surgeons are the same, okay? But how they perform the procedure has changed, okay? Mm-hmm. And I would hope that it's getting better, you know? and I know it's getting better. But it was a learning process. So you could say, well, you know, we're not interested in how appendicitis was performed or operated on 30, 50 years ago. But yet, maybe there's a body of knowledge that's super useful, right? How they went from V1 or to V2 to V3 to V4 to V29 of that procedure is very interesting. But yet, you still want the model to say, well, you know, you want to get the latest information, but you know what I mean? Like the body of knowledge if you gave an answer that was correct 50 years ago is not what you want, but mm-hmm. you probably still not need that somewhere, because again, for not just for historical value, but just to be able to understand and draw parallels, because maybe other procedures, you know, need to adapt as well over time, and maybe there's a hidden gem in how you went from the 30s way of operating to the 40s way to the 50s way. So it's very, I mean, I have no answer. but I'm just thinking, you know, some data rots, some mm-hmm. doesn't. And how do you tell? And long term, you know, how do we address that? And who should?
Yeah, I think it's growing bigger. Definitely a challenge. I think we could talk for hours about like lottering and modeling, also get very, very deep. But I would love to have like one final question,
sure.
Which is also quite hard to answer. With all your knowledge, with all your expertise in development and current insights in models and performance, where do you see the usage of AI in, I don't know, roughly 5 to 6 years, which is probably, do you think from your perspective, the exponential development will continue and to raise and to speed up? Or think that it will just be part of everyone's life and not too much will change because we're hitting a wall at some point?
So, I mean, it's pervasive, right? I mean, look at cell phones, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you live with your cell phone without your cell phone for, let's say, 48 hours?
It's going to be hard, but yeah, it would be worth it. Yeah.
If you're traveling, can you live without your cell phone for 48 hours?
Sometimes it's more fun without a cell phone.
I know, because it's not a... I lost my phone while traveling last year. Lost it at JFK in New York, of all places. And there went my boarding pass. There went my Uber, my hotel reservations,
payment,
everything.
Yeah.
Thank God I was on the way back. I lost it on the way back, so it wasn't. I didn't have to live without it for too long, but it was difficult, right? So I think AI is going to be the same. There are already plenty of, I would say, hidden uses. That we don't even notice, right? I mean, if you're looking for a Netflix movie, you're using AI. Mm-hmm. If you're again, we mentioned Spotify, right? If you're looking at the release radar on Spotify, you're using AI. If you're writing email, you'll probably have completion and a bunch of other features, you know, summarization, prioritization of your emails. That's AI.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of stuff is already embedded. And I think other use cases will just keep, popping up. And because they make sense, like I'm still waiting for the travel assistant. Why isn't anybody building this, please?
Maybe you have to.
Oh yeah, I keep joking. It's probably a bigger problem than I think it is, because otherwise it would already be there. But I still haven't seen anything that's remotely as good as I need it to be. Why do I still need to go to the Air France website or the Emirates website or the Delta website? And why do I still have to go and to hotel websites and book, or you know, train line? Like train line is great. I like them. Everybody else is honestly horrible, especially you, Air France, if you're listening. But okay, so there's still a ton, right? And I'm not even getting to education or healthcare. And
true.
I think it's going to become pervasive. I'm not sure that the chat GPT like experience will be dominant. I think we'll see more and more smart features being embedded into apps and services and products. I mean, I'm not sure I need the AI fridge or the AI microwave, but Like I said, you know, smarter apps, smarter government services, especially in here. God, mm-hmm. we need that. We need smarter government too, but that's not something AI can fix.
At some point,
maybe it will. Or maybe we'll vote for an AI one day. I don't know. I think it's just gonna be, you know, it's gonna become as pervasive as you know, mobiles, smartphones, and internet, and et cetera, and everything else. AGI, like I said, I have no idea. I'm not sure what that is. Not sure what's the point. I think, again, just to close, you know, if I could advocate for one thing, I would advocate for solving problems now. You know, mm-hmm. like look at your organizations. It doesn't matter if you're a startup or if you work in, you know, if you work at a huge company, if you work at Siemens, or I know we have a lot of German listeners. So if you work at Siemens or Bosch or BMW or Mercedes or all those amazing companies, of course, you know, your core business is whatever it is, but look around you, there's got to be 5 to 10 annoying problems that are not related to building, you know, trains or cars or mm-hmm. or electrical equipment or just basic productivity stuff that's making your life or your customer's life a little more painful than it needs to be. Start from there, you know. Start from there. I keep comparing a big company is like the engine room in a huge ship, right? It's you have a huge engine room, right? It's complicated. It's doing a lot of different things. It's unclear that anybody really understands everything that's happening there, and there are 10,000 places where things can go wrong, okay? And you need mm-hmm. to put oil every hour or every day in those 10,000 spots, okay? So those are the 10,000 tiny automation problems or slow workflows or manual processes that make your company suboptimal and, you know, break the user experience for your customers, et cetera, leak margin or revenue. Fix those, you know, today. Mm-hmm. And you don't need AGI and you don't need huge models. Be That's smart true. About it. And because you have 10,000 to solve, you know, ROI is everything and time to market and agility are everything. So you have to be smart. And I think that's what small language models can bring.
Cool. I think there couldn't be a better end to such an episode with embracing solve problems now and don't wait for it.
Move now. Act now.
That's critical. And I would love to see more German companies do also the same thing.
Absolutely.
Julian, thanks a lot for your time. Thanks a lot for all the insights. I've learned a lot about language models as well. I mean, we already had a call before. A lot of knowledge that you shared. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
And we will put every link in the show notes. Oh, yes. Everyone can follow you and see what Arki is doing. And
absolutely.
Stuff.
And don't hesitate. I mean, I'm easy to find on LinkedIn and anywhere else. So yeah, if anybody out there wants to.
I can highly recommend if you want to get deep into the rabbit hole, get to your YouTube channel.
Yes, and on YouTube too.
Cool. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Have a great day. Cheers to Paris. And talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks. Bye-bye.